Well, greetings everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries daily worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on redemption and the straw man right after this. Now, let me ask you this. What do you think's wrong with the Ten Commandments? Because it's pretty obvious that something is wrong with the Ten Commandments because they've been banned from our public schools, our public institutions, and our national consciousness. Now, instead of these ten simple time-tested laws, we see the ten planks to the Communist Manifesto in their place, and they're teaching these ten planks to the Communist Manifesto in our public schools, our public institutions, and now we've made them a part of our national psyche. You know, this is a pretty radical change in our political and moral outlook over the past 50 years, don't you think? Are you aware, for instance, that your daughter couldn't receive an aspirin in your public school without your consent, but your daughter can have an abortion arranged? That's right, an abortion through that same public school nurse without even your knowledge, much less your consent. That's why I contend that the solution to this kind of moral perversion and national insanity is to go back to what worked. Let's go back to the Ten Commandments and the Mosaic Law. You know, our founding fathers practiced and advocated the Ten Commandments. They even put 22 principles of that law into our federal constitution. And there is at least one school left in America that teaches this entire Mosaic Law, the Ten Commandments and all 759 statutes, judgments, and commandments, as well as the penalties and the 33 benefits that we all receive for their observance. You know, every law has a penalty. You don't have to know what the penalty is to suffer from its effect. Now, whether we call this the Mosaic Law or the Law of God or the Common Law or Natural Law or Karma or something else, it works automatically. It works just like AIDS, herpes, and VD, which just happened to be the automatic penalty for adultery. If you'd like more information, why don't you call and order our free General Law CD package? That's the place to start. It's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. Now, it's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free. You can call and order one right now. The number is 417-273-4967. If you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. Just click on to the email and send us an email request for that free General Law CD package. Now, once more, that's georgegordon.org or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Why don't you do it right now while you're thinking about it before you forget? All right, we've been talking this week about redemption, the straw man, accepted for value, alter egos, UCC 1-207, redemption process, cite drafts, affidavits of truth and commerce, and a whole host and plethora of words and buzzwords in between to describe this phenomenon that's been going on now for at least 10 to 15 years and is now worldwide. I opened by telling you a man from Australia came in here with this redemption story, and I receive about a call a day on redemption or some aspect of it. Larry Beecraft wrote a treatise on the subject matter of destroyed arguments, of which one of them was this UCC argument and this a collateral story called Redemption and Straw Man. And, oh my God, there's just it just goes on and on. And I've said before, I think it's a pile of crap, but if that's what you want to do, don't let me get in the way of your happiness and success. Get after it. But now, the other side of it, here at the end of the series here, we should talk about, well, what works? If redemption and straw man doesn't work, then what does work? So in the last program, I said, well, here's what works for George Gordon as it relates to the income tax. I stopped having income, and I started practicing the Ten Commandment model of economics, particularly as it applies to insurance and taxes, and it works like a shot for me. And it works like a shot for many of my students who have done it and tried it. I don't know of anybody that's failed or gone to prison because they've practiced the Ten Commandment model as it relates to taxes. Although there might be some. In the Bible, we find Daniel went into the lion's den. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego went into the fiery furnace. Peter was in prison. The Messiah was executed practicing this law. Those are exceptions to the rule. There's a general rule that doesn't happen to Joe Sixpacks and Sally Housewives, but it could. So, what works? That's what people want to know. What in the hell works? All right, so let me tell you a couple of stories here and a couple of modalities. First of all, religious free exercise is the biggest single club that you have under the Constitution of the United States. And I would venture a guess to say that you Australians, New Zealanders, Western Europeans, you French, Norwegians, and Belgians, and Swedes, and Canadians, all of us that practice Western civilization, as we call it, the Western democratic societies, practice Anglo-Saxon administration. And under Anglo-Saxon administration, going back to Magna Carta, Alfred the Great, Kent's commentaries, Blackstone's commentaries, and so on. As we look back to Moses at Mount Sinai, we find that the old covenant negotiated by Moses with God at the top of Mount Sinai is the basis of Anglo-Saxon administration to this day. The Apostle Paul, if he were resurrected this afternoon, could walk into any federal district court in the United States of America and practice law just like he did the day was practicing before Festus. There'd be a few modifications. He wouldn't know the dress code. He wouldn't have the local rules of court. He'd need those. He'd probably need a modern dictionary. Of course, he'd have to be able to speak English in this country. But the Roman civil law is the modality of law that we have adopted here under Anglo-Saxon administration. The Apostle Paul was an expert in Roman civil law. I don't see any reason why he couldn't practice law today. Now, the creator of the universe, the God of creation, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, wants you and everybody on planet Earth, every Chinese coolie, Every poor guy living wherever he's living, making $2 a day, struggling to survive. He wants you to have a legal education. He thinks that law is the most important aspect of your education. A legal education is what he requires. Of course, you know, we came along and said, nah, that's a bunch of poppycock. But then, you know, once in a while, we might have made a mistake. You know, maybe you ought to consider it. Don't have to do it. I just said, well, maybe you ought to consider it. So let me show you a story here called Randy Fry. Now, Randy Fry is not a religious guy. He used the Roman civil law to make his defense. He did not use religious free exercise. There's a statement in here that deals with Jesus and him crucified. And have you given your heart to Jesus today? Not a word. But Randy Fry got a letter from the Department of Social Services. This is back in 1986, just as an illustration. It could have occurred 50 years ago or tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock. You may get one of these letters from Social Lady, who's complaining about the way you're raising the state's kid. And Randy Fry has got a child. I think he was 6 years old. Yeah, here it is. No, we don't know. Children under six. I don't know how old his kid was, but he was 6, 8 years old, something like that. And he was homeschooling him in Michigan, state of Michigan, here in the United States. So one day, Sherry Salmonson, social lady for the Department of Social Services in St. Joseph County, centered in Centerville, Michigan, wrote this letter. Here's what she had to say. She said, "Dear Mr. and Mrs. Fry, this is to inform you that there has been a complaint filed with the Children's Protective Services stating that your son Robert is not attending school because you have not enrolled him and do not choose to have him attend. I contacted the Sturgis Public Schools and found that Robert was not enrolled and that you had been contacted about this matter. And I'm told that you reported that Robert is enrolled in another school, but that you refused to state what that school was. Now, please be informed that Michigan law requires that children 6 years and older must receive an education in an accredited program." And I underlined the word accredited program. "It is your right to select the program, but it must meet the requirements of the law. So if you refuse to comply with the law, you may be subject to prosecution or to charges of child neglect. Now, I attempted recently to visit you at your home to discuss this matter, but I didn't find anyone at home. So please contact me by phone or letter to let me know if the above information is incorrect and to verify your son's attendance in an approved program. So if you have any questions about your legal obligations and responsibilities or your choices, I'll be happy to discuss these with you. Please contact the Children's Protective Services Unit at by Friday, October the 24th, to verify Robert's attendance or to set up an appointment to discuss this matter. If we do not hear from you by that date, we will initiate legal action. Period. Sincerely, Sherry Salmonson, Department of Social Services." Now, this is the letter from hell. Most parents absolutely fear this kind of letter coming from the Department of Social Services. It just sets their teeth on edge. That's why you send your kid to public school. That's why you're always alert, you know, like a deer in the forest. You're always alert with your head up looking around while you're chewing, looking for that wolf or coyote or bear or something, you know, it's going to attack you. Well, why is that? You know, this is your child. This is the fruit of your body, ladies. Why should you fear the state of Michigan or any other government agency? What in the hell have they got to do with raising your child? Well, you don't know, and I do, and now I'm going to tell you. You see, when you got your marriage license, boys and girls, you signed a three-party limited general partnership with the state. And then the state came to you and said, "Now, fill out this birth certificate registration and file that." And when you finished with those two, that child is no longer yours, but is now the property of the state, is owned by the state, regulated and controlled by the state, and you've been reduced to a mere trustee in equity over the state's property. In short, you're nothing more than a babysitter. Now, Sherry Salmonson here is the state's administrator. She is the state's agent. See, the state is just a piece of paper in a file cabinet someplace. It's a fiction. There is no such thing as the state of Michigan. It's a fiction of law. It exists. It can sue and be sued. It makes laws. It's a paper person. It's a corporation, that's what it is. And it's got a board of directors called the legislature. And it's got a chief executive officer. You call him the governor. They have a legal department. It's called your Supreme Court. And then they have in their legal department lots of prosecutors. And they've got stockholders. They're called taxpayers. It's a corporation. We don't call it a corporation. We call it the state. But that's what it is. It's a corporation. And it makes laws. It's a sovereign, and it's got certain powers. It's got what they call the police powers. And it operates in contradistinction to the law of God. It is the exact opposite. It's the mirror image opposite to the Ten Commandments and the law of God. Well, the law of the Creator. Not the law of your God. I'm not suggesting that. Hell, you're probably a Christian, and you're in full harmony with the state of Michigan. Probably believe in and have a marriage license and birth certificates for all your children. You practice this law. You love it. But you're fearful of it. By God, I'll bet you you're terrified of it, especially when you get this letter from hell. Now, Randy was one of my students years ago, and he sent me this letter, and he said, Mr. Gordon, I got this letter, and I'm educating my boy Robert in homeschool, and I was smart enough to keep my mouth shut. Notice that she said up here in the opening of the letter, first paragraph, I contacted the Sturgis Public Schools and found that Robert was not enrolled and that you had been contacted about this matter. And I am told that you reported that Robert is enrolled in another school, but that you refused to state what that school was. Randy Fry kept his mouth shut. He did not give Sherry Salmonson or the state of Michigan any evidence to be used against him. He said, I've got a boy named Robert. He's enrolled in school, and I ain't telling you where. If you want to litigate, let's get after it. All right. Now, how do you defend that? Well, here's what Randy did. I said, now, you have to answer. So I want you to write a letter and tell these people what you're doing and why. And you specifically need to tell them that you don't have a marriage license and don't have a birth certificate, that you're not seeking any state benefits, you're not accepting any, that you're a Hebrew, that you practice the Ten Commandments, and that you're practicing the law of God. He wrote that letter. He said, now here's what I'm doing and here's why. When he got through, I'm not going to read the letter, his letter is several pages long. When he got through writing the letter, he comes to the final conclusion. Now notice that this first letter that he received was written on October the 20th. He responded with a letter dated October the 23rd. So 3 days after he received her letter, or probably when if her letter was dated the 20th, he probably received it the 22nd or 23rd. He turned right around and he dated his letter October the 23rd. He sent her a letter right back. And he talked about Title 18 of the U.S. Code, and he talked about peonage. And what else did he talk about here? He conspiracy to commit an offense. And he wrote her a legal response. He said, you know, lady, if we need to get after it, we'll do it. But now, on November the 13th, now this is 3 weeks later, Sherry Salmonson now writes a letter back to Randy, and here's what it says, just one sentence. It says, upon a review of your case, the St. Joseph County Department of Social Services has determined that we will not be proceeding with our investigation. Sincerely, Sherry Salmonson. So 3 weeks, that's all it took. Here's a parent. He gets a letter from hell from social lady. He writes her a response back. She writes a letter back. Within 3 weeks, whole thing's taken care of. But, you know, you need to address it. You can't just ignore it. And this is not a religious free exercise defense, although that would have been good. You know, you used a Roman civil law defense and solved the problem. So there is an answer to the riddle, but it's not from the straw man. I don't know of any successes under straw man or redemption, but I do know of successes under code pleading the statutes or responding under the civil law or religious free exercise. Okay, now let me tell you another story here on religious free exercise, which I contend is the biggest club that you've got available to you. Most people don't use it, don't know how, wouldn't have a clue. But the courts and the literature are just filled with all kinds of examples, like Yoder versus Wisconsin, you know, is a good one. Now, there was a case one time came back, a student of mine called up here at the law school, and he said, now, and here's the gist of the story, he said, six of my friends were in court the other day in Texas, and they were all arrested and jailed for contempt of court. And I'm calling to find out what should we or what could we do. So I said, well, Chris, lay it on me. What happened? And he said, well, these six guys went in, and in Texas there's a statute that requires that you stand up when the judge comes into the courtroom. And, of course, these six guys did not stand up. And so the judge admonished them and recited the law, the Texas statute 22-404, that requires that the people in the courtroom rise when the judge enters. So he said, I'm going to leave the courtroom, and the bailiff is going to call the court into session. And when I come into the room, I will expect you to comply with this statute. Now, I don't know if the judge, I can't remember if the judge said, or if you don't want to comply with the statute, get out of the courtroom. Because, see, you can come into court after it's in session. But if you're in the courtroom, when it's called into session, the custom here in Anglo-Saxon administration, although, you know, I can tell you from personal experience, from Idaho and Missouri and so on, when people are in the courtroom and the judge comes in, we all stand up. Now, I don't know if you do where you're at in your country, wherever you're at, but in this country. Now, where does that come from? I don't know. In Idaho, there's no law that requires it. Here in Missouri, I always stand up when the judge comes into the courtroom, and most times the other people do not. And the judge always looks at me and says, thank you, Mr. Gordon, you may be seated. And so I nod and I sit down. Now, I can tell you here in Missouri, it's not a law, rule, regulation. It's not even a custom, usage, or practice here. Although some of us do and some of us don't, depending upon where we were educated, you know, and so on. Now, the Apostle Paul made an observation one time in the New Testament. Remember, the New Testament wasn't written by the Apostle Paul. It was written by the Creator of the universe himself, using Paul as his scribe, where it says all Scripture is given by inspiration of God, and it's profitable for doctrine, reproof, correction, and instruction. Well, anyway, the Apostle Paul was inspired to write that custom to whom custom. Not that it's idolatry or that there's some law that requires it, but, you know, if I was in Texas, I would stand up because that's the way I was educated. In fact, in our home, it was a requirement that when an adult and an elder came into the room, you had to stand up. And then you had to address him as sir or ma'am. You know, it was kind of an old thing that we did back in the 20s and 30s, and it kind of bled into the 40s. But by the time we got up to about 1950, you know, if your parents came into the room, you know, it's what the hell do you want and why are you invading my space? I can assure you, boys and girls, it was not always like that in this country. It is like that today, but it wasn't always like that. There was a time in America when we respected our elders and we respected our public officials. Now, these public officials, by the way, sit in the seat of Moses. If you want to see that, you go to Deuteronomy chapter 1. And there's some more said about it in Romans chapter 13, about this thing of respecting the public officials, you know, that are in your community, in your government. I mean, hell, they may be working for Satan the devil, but they occupy the office, and an office is an important attribute of God himself. Office, you know, it's the office of the president. The president may be a jerk, but not his office. Because the office of president is the seat of Moses. President Obama is sitting in the seat of Moses. Now, the Chief Justice Roberts is sitting in the seat of Aaron the high priest. Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid are a couple of renegades over here making law in opposition to and in violation of the law of God and the Ten Commandments. But at least our Supreme Court and our president are offices created by God himself, and they should be respected. Now, as a custom, not a law now, but as a custom in the United States, in most jurisdictions, we rise when a judge comes into his courtroom. These six men in Texas did not do that. So the judge went out, he came back in, and when he came in the second time, these six men did not rise, even though he had informed them now of the statute and had instructed them to either leave the courtroom or rise. Although I don't know if he instructed them that they could leave the courtroom, but I did tell you that they could have. All right, they didn't. So he said, okay, boys, now this is where the rubber meets the road. You boys are in contempt of court, or are just about to be. So I'm going to leave one more time, and I'm going to come in. And you boys had better either be standing on your feet, or you better be out of here. I'm sure he told them to get out, but I don't remember that part of the story. Or I'm going to hold you in contempt and sentence you to 30 days in jail. So here they come. The judge goes out. He comes back in. These guys are still sitting down, so he orders the bailiff to arrest them. And he remands them to the custody of the bailiff, and he hauls them off to jail for 30 days for open contempt in the judge's presence. Now, Chris calls me, and he says, now, Chris wasn't one of them. He's one of their buddies. He calls me and says, what are we going to do? Now, I didn't resort to the redemption or straw man or anything else. I resorted to the contempt statutes and the contempt cases. I've done my research on contempt of court. I probably do not know everything that there is to know about contempt. I'm sure there's a lot that I could learn. But I do know a little bit about contempt. And as Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes was once asked, how much law do you know? And he said, well, I don't know very much, but I am god-awful good at the little bit that I do know. And so I'd like to reiterate that by saying, well, I don't know much about contempt, but I'm god-awful good at the little bit that I do know. And the little bit that I do know goes a long ways. So I asked Chris, I said, was there some reason why these boys could not rise, such as, I know this maxim of law that the court does not expect you to do the impossible. So immediately my mind turned to, well, these boys are Vietnam veterans with no legs. They lost their legs in the war. And the judge is expecting them to rise and stand when he comes in when they have no legs to rise and stand upon. Therefore, it's impossible for these six men to stand or to rise when the judge comes in. Therefore, the judge is in error here, and his decision should be reversed. So I said, well, do they have legs to stand on? He said, yeah, they do. I said, all six of them? He said, they do. I said, well, then that defense isn't going to work, is it? Okay. Well, are there any other defenses that we might use? I said, do these boys have any religious objections to rising when the judge comes in? And Chris said, well, what do you mean, religious objection? I said, well, do they hold the view that to rise when the judge came in would be an act of idolatry in violation of the first commandment? And Chris said, you know, by God, I think maybe that might be it. That maybe that's what the problem was. And I said, well, if they had a truly and sincerely held religious belief pursuant to Seeger versus U.S., which is a standard that was set down by the Supreme Court in Seeger versus U.S. I'll just recite it here, too, if I can find it. Yeah, here it is. We hasten to emphasize the truth of a belief is not open to question, but there remains the significant question as to whether it's truly held. This is the threshold question of sincerity which must be resolved in every case. Did they have a truly and sincerely held religious belief concerning standing when the judge came in? Now, there are 10 standards. I'll give you those 10. The five winning standards are religious belief and training, a belief in God, a duty to God as an individual, which is truly and sincerely held. but it cannot be political, sociological, philosophical, economic, or a merely personal moral code. Those are the five losers. So Chris went to the jail to visit his five or six friends, and they all filed a petition with the state Supreme Court. And the petition with the state Supreme Court was a writ of habeas corpus. It's a petition for writ of habeas corpus when you're being illegally or unlawfully detained or held in jail. And so they alleged that they had a truly and sincerely held religious belief, and that because of that, the judge then erred, and that they should have a rehearing, at least, or a reversal. So the Supreme Court, acting on, and this is important with habeas corpus, an emergency writ of habeas corpus, because remember, habeas corpus takes some time to wind its way through the process. These guys are only sentenced to 30 days. So the court has to act with dispatch. And they did. These boys were released by the state Supreme Court, all six of them, on the 14th day. Now, that's the fastest that I've ever heard of a writ of habeas corpus working. I had one time that I was working on that worked in 18 days in Tulsa, Oklahoma. I have had them work in 20 days. That's pretty common. They almost always, under an emergency writ of habeas corpus. Now, if with just a standard writ of habeas corpus, it'll take 30 to 60 days just to normally work its way through the process. So remember, it's got to be an emergency writ. All right, so now the boys are out, but they're not released by a reversal. It's by a remand. It was remanded for further proceedings, which we will take up right after this. You are listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's eight schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. And the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school at 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. In the Law Hour, an editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that the authors or publications that we're endorsing are necessarily going to reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review either. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they do not necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org or call us direct at 417-273-4967. 4967. All right, we're back, and we are now ready to take up the subject matter of redemption and the straw man as to what works. Now, we've discussed this in this series of programs that redemption and the straw man and the UCC and the rest of this crap doesn't work. And so, naturally, people want to know, well, what does? What does? Well, code pleading works. Code pleading works. That's where you take the law as it's already settled, and then you try to conform to that law. Do you fit within the exceptions of the law? Code plead it out and see, did you in fact do that? Maybe the court, maybe the judge, maybe the police, you know, maybe the agent over here made a mistake. Now, religious free exercise is important, and we'll come to that in a moment, but code pleading is my first line of defense, and then we go to religious free exercise, which is the biggest, best club you have. All right, these six guys are brought forward, and a new hearing is scheduled just for these six boys, and it was scheduled for, we'll say, June 16th or whatever. And so on the date and time certain, the six boys appear in court. Now, the judge comes in and says, now, I sentenced you to 30 days in jail for contempt of court because you didn't rise when I came into the courtroom based upon this statute, number 22404, or whatever it is. And the six of you have filed a petition for writ of habeas corpus, which has been granted. And the Supreme Court remanded this case back to this trial court for further proceedings. And this is the date and time set certain for those proceedings. Now, he said, what we're here to determine is whether or not you are in violation of the statute 22404. And I'm going to walk out of the courtroom. And then I'm going to come into the courtroom, and the bailiff here is going to call the court into session. And if you six boys rise for the judge when he comes in, then I'm going to release you. I'm going to let you go. But if you persist and if you sit in your chairs and you don't rise when I come in, then I'm going to send you back to serve out the remainder of your 30-day sentence, which is 16 more days in jail. So the judge walked out, and the bailiff called the court to into session, and the judge walked in, and five of the six were standing up when the judge came in. So the judge came over to the bench and he sat down. He said, now, you five men who are standing, bailiff, take those five men and arrest them and take them back to jail. And the bailiff came over and he took the five men who were standing, who had followed the judge's instructions, the five men who had filed a petition for the writ of habeas corpus claiming religious free exercise, the five men who were instructed that if they would rise when the judge came in, that he would release them. He'd let them go. The judge turned on them, and he had them all arrested and hauled out and jailed, and they served out their 16 days. What happened here? And what happened to the one man who did not rise? He held his chair. Well, you see, the other five guys decided that they'd already been in jail for 14 days, they'd had enough, and that they didn't want to spend any more time in jail, and the judge said he'd let them go if they would rise. So when the judge came in, they stood up, which proved that they had no truly and sincerely held religious beliefs. None. Zero. Zilch. They were lying hypocrites. And they rightfully went to jail. But what about the one man who did not rise? Well, he settled with the state of Texas for an undisclosed amount in an out-of-court settlement for false imprisonment. So I don't know what he got. Never heard. But I could, from my experience, tell you that he got paid at least $1,000 a day, which was $14,000, because that's the standard that was set at Selma, Alabama, for false imprisonment. So that's the nuisance value settlement, and he might have got more than that. So he got paid for his 14 days, and he didn't go back, because he did, in fact, demonstrate that he had truly and sincerely held religious beliefs, and that you could throw him into the lion's den or the fiery furnace, and he would not flinch. Which is why I always tell my students, if you can't go to jail, you can't do this. Jail's the only thing they got to offer. It's the only punishment that they can do to you. They're going to throw you in jail. Well, okay. It isn't like, you know, they're going to throw you in a labor camp for 30 years or that they're going to kill you or pull your fingernails out or waterboard you or something, you know, when it's all said and done. All right. Now, bottom line here. Truly and sincerely held religious beliefs come from Seeger versus U.S. And so let's take a look at Seeger and find out what the provisions are. And this case is cited at 380 U.S. 163. 380 U.S. 163, called United States versus Seeger. The test of religious belief within the meaning of the exemption in 6J is whether it is a sincere and meaningful belief, occupying in the life of its possessor a place parallel to that filled by the God of those admittedly qualified for the exemption. The exemption does not cover those who oppose war from a merely personal moral code, nor those who decide that war is wrong on the basis of essentially political, sociological, or economic considerations, rather than religious belief. Now, local boards and courts are to decide whether the objector's beliefs are sincerely held and whether they are, in his own scheme of things, religious. They are not to require proof of the religious doctrines, nor are they to reject beliefs because they are not comprehensible. So if you're going to make this claim to religious free exercise, let's test it a little bit. Let's suppose you're a Catholic, Protestant, or a Jew, and you want to educate your child at home in a home school. Do you have any truly and sincerely held religious beliefs concerning this home schooling? Well, if you do, they probably aren't going to go anywhere because Catholics, Protestants, and Jews send their children to public schools, parochial schools, and if they want to, they can also educate them in their home schools if the home school qualifies. What if your home school doesn't qualify? Does the home school have to qualify? Or maybe you could have a home school that wouldn't qualify by your state standards, but it would qualify under religious free exercise, such as under Yoder versus Wisconsin. All right. Let's take a look. There are five winners and five losers. If you have religious training and belief, a belief in God based upon duties which are truly and sincerely held as an individual, those are the five winners. If you have political, sociological, philosophical, economic, or personal beliefs, those will not carry the day. So you get five winners and five losers, and you have to have all 10 of these in order, and you're going to be examined and questioned concerning your religious training and belief, your belief in God, your duty to God, your truly and sincerely held beliefs as an individual. And you're going to be questioned concerning your political, sociological, philosophical, economic, and personal moral codes. And if you can get all of them correct, you win. If you miss on any one of the 10, you lose. So it's either you get all 10 correct or you lose. All right. Now, with that in mind, the parties raised the basic question of the constitutionality of the section which defines the term religious training and belief as used in the Act as an individual's belief in a relation to a supreme being involving duties superior to those arising from any human relation, but not including essentially political, sociological, philosophical, or merely personal moral codes. And we have concluded that Congress, in using the expression supreme being rather than the designation of God. So for you people that use the designation Jehovah or Allah or supreme being or Jehovah or whatever name, Yahweh, Yeshua, it covers all of you. All of you. You can be a Buddhist, you can be a Muslim, you can be of any of these religious persuasions. And furthermore, the United Nations protects this. And furthermore, as far as I know, all of the Anglo-Saxon countries do. And if you're living in China or Russia, which are not Anglo-Saxon administered countries, then the Declaration on Human Rights does. From the United Nations. Nearly all these countries belong to the United Nations. Not all, but most. Now, there are a few countries that don't belong to the United Nations, and there's probably a few countries that don't practice Anglo-Saxon administration. And maybe you've got a constitution or rules, regulations, customs, usages, and practices that are different therefrom. So take a look at your own statutes. Take a look at your own constitution. But I'll bet you that the God of creation has provided for your civil law and your religious free exercise protections. Not so that you can practice Muslim theology or Buddhist theology or Christian theology or Jewish theology, but that you can practice the law of the Creator of the universe, the law of God, so that you can follow your instructions. No government on this planet is going to interfere with you obeying God and keeping His commandments. That is against the law. God Himself won't allow that. Which is why here in the West we have all of these refinements in our law. But there's more. The hearing officer found that the claim was based upon a personal moral code and that he was not sincere in his claim. And in a later form, he hedged the question as to his belief in a supreme being by saying that it depended on the definition. And he appended a statement that he felt it a violation of his personal moral code to take human life, and that he considered his belief superior to the obligation or to his obligation to the state. Oh, you can't do that. See, most of you people out there are citizens of your state. If you're a citizen of Germany, you cannot impose your view, your beliefs, ahead of the state of Germany. If you're a citizen of Canada, you cannot impose your beliefs ahead of your God, Canada. No, they won't allow that. But if you have a belief that's based upon a duty to the Creator of the universe, you can impose that belief and that duty ahead of Canada, ahead of Germany, ahead of the United States. But it's more than just a duty or a personal moral code. Now, remember, we got all 10. Now, both morals and sound policy require that the state should not violate the conscience of the individual. And it may well be questioned whether the state, which preserves its life by a subtle policy of violation of the conscience of the individual, will not, in fact, ultimately lose it by that process. So it's individual belief, not your membership in a church now. No, not your membership as a Catholic in the Catholic Church. It's your belief as an individual. Now, this act, including its conscientious objector provisions, was upheld against constitutional attack in the selective draft law cases. And indeed, the consensus of the witnesses appearing before the congressional committees was that individual belief, rather than membership in a church or sect, determined the duties that God imposed upon a person in his everyday conduct, and that there is a higher loyalty than loyalty to this country, and that is loyalty to God. Now, Acts 5:29 tells you that we should obey God rather than men. And in Leviticus 18, verses 3 through 5, we've been instructed we are not to follow the laws of our countries and our states ahead of the law of God, but we are to follow the law of God, all 759 statutes. And yes, if need be, to hell with the law of the United States. Now, take that quotation down. Now, there is a caveat to that. There is something to be said for Romans chapter 13. And I don't deny it. But Romans 13 cannot be taken out of context to the exclusion of Acts 5:29 and to the exclusion of Leviticus 18, verses 3 through 5. Paul's instruction through God. Remember, all Scripture is given by inspiration of God. It is not by inspiration of Paul, it's by inspiration of the Creator Himself. And it was God Almighty Himself that wrote Romans 13, 1 through 6. Not Paul, not anybody else. God Himself. The same guy that wrote Acts 5:29 wrote Romans 13, 1. The same guy that wrote Romans 13, 1 through 6 wrote Leviticus 18, verses 3 through 5. Now the three go hand in hand. The judge in this case that I reported to you in Texas is the agent of the Creator of the universe. He may not be following the law of God, but he is his agent. He sits in that seat. He sits in the seat of Moses, the judgment seat, the executive seat. The priest is a judicial officer. The priests are our judges. That's why I tell you. You're going to find more reason, logic, and common sense in the priesthood, in the judges, than you're going to find in your politics, than you're going to find in Nancy Pelosi and Dianne Feinstein. And then it needs to be used and used responsibly. And the judges and the police and the government officers are not a threat to you. They are God's officers and ministers, and the wrongdoer is the guy that should be fearful. The guy that violates the Ten Commandments is the guy that's fearful. It's the murderer. It's the robber. It's the car thief. But that does not mean that when the state comes in and tells you that you're to sign a contract with the state or use unjust weights and balances or pay the income tax, that you should do any of the above, because those are criminal activities. Now there's one more caveat. If you have voluntarily gotten a Social Security number, taken a job, and you are now serving bail, well, okay, Jesus gave you that one too. He said, okay, then render unto bail that which is bailed. Pay your income tax if you signed up for it. Pay your Social Security if you signed up for it. But you also ought to be informed that Social Security is limited liability and it's a crime. And so what we see here with this concept of redemption and straw man, these are criminals. These are people who have signed up. They are Baal worshippers. They're citizens. And they're not paying their income tax, or they're not paying their child support. They're not obeying their God. And then when their God calls them into question, they say, well, here's our defense, straw man and redemption and UCC. And it falls right on its face. And as it should. It has no legal merit. Now, religious free exercise does have merit. You know, for people that are not Baal worshippers, people that do obey God and keep His commandments. There's something to be said for that. Now the court goes on to say, putting aside dogmas with their particular conceptions of deity, freedom of conscience itself implies respect for an innate conviction of paramount duty. The battle for religious liberty has been fought and won with respect to religious beliefs and practices which are not in conflict with good order. upon the very ground of the supremacy of conscience within its proper field. So when you walk in and say, "I'm terribly sorry, Your Honor, but I cannot take this oath," the way you approach the judge is to file a motion ahead of your testimony in trial and say to the judge, "I am a conscientious objector. I'm a Hebrew, or whatever you are, and I don't take this oath, nor do I affirm, but rather I follow the teachings of the Scripture that say, let my yea be yea and my nay be nay." And then cite Gordon versus Idaho at the same time, because I tested that issue, and the courts agree. But remember this phrase that does not conflict with good order. Let's let the judge know in advance so that there can be order in the court that you're not going to take the oath. And here's why. It violates the law of God. It violates Matthew 5:33 through 35:33 through 36 or 7 and James 5:12. And as a result of that, I cannot take this oath or affirm. So simple that is. Now you've got good order. Now the validity of what you believe, listen to this, the validity of what he believes cannot be questioned. Some theologians and indeed some examiners might be tempted to question the existence of the registrant's supreme being or the truth of his concepts, but these are inquiries foreclosed to government. That's a very powerful statement. The validity of what you believe, partner, cannot be questioned. Some theologians and indeed some examiners might be tempted to question the existence of the registrant supreme being or the truth of his concepts or his beliefs, but these are inquiries foreclosed to government. As Mr. Justice Douglas stated in U.S. versus Ballard, men may believe what they cannot prove. They may not be put to the proof of their religious doctrines or beliefs. Religious experiences, which are as real as life to some, may be incomprehensible to others. And local boards and courts in this sense are not free to reject beliefs because they consider them incomprehensible. Their task is to decide whether the beliefs professed by a registrant are sincerely held and whether they are in his own scheme of things religious. It's personal, and it's decided by res judicata, not by stare decisis. But we hasten to emphasize that while the truth of the belief is not open to question, there remains the significant question as to whether it's truly held. And this is the threshold question of sincerity, which must be resolved in every single case. It's truly and sincerely held. Now remember, there's five winners and there's five losers. Religious free exercise and code pleading are two alternatives to this thing of redemption and straw man. It's not the only alternatives, but it's the two best alternatives. Redemption and straw man have been demonstrated over the last 15 or 20 years, as long as it's been around, to be a loser. But religious free exercise, specifically pursuant to Seeger, and code pleading, as I've explained, have proven to be consistent winners. And so the choice is yours. If you want to be a winner, you do what the winners do. And if you want to be a loser, then you do what the losers do. Straw man and redemption are a couple of proven losers. All right, you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio worldwide. For more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.